honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
If we want to see that dream consistently fulfilled, it's up to each of us to set that example. And that's a sentiment echoed on this program by many over the years who served in America's then segregated armed forces during World War II. Earl Watson was part of the 1317th Engineer General Services Regiment building bridges in Europe.
We reached the Rhine River and we put a red bridge across there in 11 days under fire. And that was a horrible thing. They don't call that a battle, the Rhine River, but it was a battle because it was under fire, and you could only stay up there about 3 hours because of the odor and everything else. And we got across that Rhine River, and to make a long story short, we ran into the Russians in the middle of Germany, where we were working on the train tracks, and ran into the Russians, and we knew the war was over because we met the Russians in the heart of Germany. And then after that, they said they were going to put us on a boat for 65 days, on our way to Manila, France, the Philippines, go by home, go right by the United States and not go home after 3 years. I'm telling you, it was an awful thing. And then they said in the ship, U.S. Harry Taylor, they said, watch the bow of the ship as it points towards New York. We're going home. And, man, we saw that Statue of Liberty from a little bitty dot until it grew very large, and we landed in New York and took a train upstate New York, and I had a very bad problem on the train. Train stopped for a half an hour, and all the soldiers got off, and they refused to sell me an American hot dog after all that time. And I was crying, and I didn't want to argue with the guy that was selling the hot dogs. And the white soldiers asked me, how come I don't have a hot dog? And I told them he refused to sell me one. So they ordered me three hot dogs, and wouldn't pay them for their hot dog, and said they ought to beat them up. And we got on the train, and it went on up to Camp Shanks up there in New York. And then I was discharged from the Army, and being from Chicago, where it's so cold and living during the Depression and everything, that I decided that I would take my release and go to California and live with my sister and my brother.
That move to California ended up connecting him to quite a few celebrities once he became the doorman at Hollywood's Knickerbocker Hotel. The late Earl Watson even wrote a book about that. Tuskegee Airman Frank Macon also wrote a book that I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. The runway where Frank learned to fly is the one cadets at the U.S. Air Force Academy now use in Frank's native Colorado Springs. But heading to Alabama as a young pilot during World War II brought some new experiences for Frank.
I wasn't used to being down south, and I wasn't used to that because the school I went to was integrated. Native Americans, Mexicans, and blacks were all, and along Irish and everybody else was, And so it was just really confusing to me. And water, I had to go into this bathroom or a toilet, facility. Or I couldn't drink out of this fountain and all of that. And it was just really ridiculous, and I had just never been involved in anything like that.
And, of course, a lot of these pilots that you're studying with and training with had grown up in the South and had a much different experience. How eye-opening was that for you to glean some of what they'd been through?
The thing was that, I couldn't understand anything they were saying, and they couldn't understand anything I was saying. When they found out I came from Colorado, Well, the first thing was, we're fighting the Indians all the time, And, of course, I just play it up. And my grandfather was an Indian. and they wanted to know, how do you do out there? I said, of course he wasn't. I said, my grandfather's chief of the tribe, And the guys from Denver, there was some in there, And they just help along with them. there were so many phraseology I was used to. I just had no knowledge of the way they talked, and it was really confusing. In basic, we were in Biloxi, Mississippi. It was strange. I don't know how to put it, but having to go to a separate restroom or something like that. And I said, well, I'll be glad I get out of this place, you know. And then, of course, got to Tuskegee. And Tuskegee's really not in the town of Tuskegee. It's in a place called Greenwood. It's a suburb. And if you went to Tuskegee, the town, the atmosphere was much different. You could just feel it, you know. But out in Greenwood, you just didn't see any whites. Of course, now when we got to, and our instructor, we're all black. But then when we got to the air base, started in basic and advanced, all of those were whites. And a lot of them are from the north, so they weren't too bad.
And, you know, with the lens of history, we can look back now and say that what all of you did during World War II, the African-American soldiers, sailors, airmen, who risked their lives, laid the groundwork for the civil rights movement, that they showed our blood is just as red as any other American, that if we can die for our country, we deserve some rights. We say that now, but did you guys have a sense then that there was something you had a chance to prove?
Now, I don't know about the rest of the group, but I didn't feel that I had anything to prove. I knew what I could do, and I had learned to fly before I even went there, and they cautioned me here, never mention that you know how to fly. So I didn't, and an airplane was just as normal as an automobile to me. So my mindset was not as the others.
Well, you hadn't dealt with the degree of prejudice in your life that they had, I guess.
No, and the other thing is, I felt much different than most of them because I just didn't seem to think like they thought, you know. I was practically raised with white people, you know, and they used to say that, what do they call it? Say that you're an Oriole, you're dark on the outside and white on the inside. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's true, but I didn't realize it. I don't look at a white person. I do not look at a, quote, black person, and those terminologies. I have never seen a white person in my life, and I've never seen a black one. You take a piece of paper, a white, and put your hand on her, you're not white. I take that same black piece of paper and put it on her. And this color and dividing people up by color or something like that is stupid. Just absolutely stupid.
You would not have found any argument to that from Frank Macon's fellow Tuskegee Airman Bob Friend, who flew 142 missions in P-51 Mustangs in the 15th Air Force during World War II. If you've ever seen the film Red Tails, you have an idea of how expendable those red-tailed P-51s were in their role of protecting the all-important bombers as their first line of defense.
We were that. There's no doubt about that. And certainly, the objective was to allow that bomber to do its mission. And certainly, yes, we were the buffer. But strangely enough, they didn't concentrate on us nearly as much as they did on trying to get the bombers down. So it was fairly easy, as a rule, to chase them off. Don't get me wrong, they would get through sometime because they'd get above and start a dive and just dive straight through. It's almost like suicide. You're going to get caught and picked up after, if not before he gets there. But they, too, had an objective, and that was protect their homeland.
And they had a variety of different planes. At the end of the war, they had planes that were faster and superior to even the one you were flying. Did you ever engage any of those ME-262s?
Yes, I met a 262, and strangely, I met him head-on, and I didn't realize we were going head-on. I thought first that I was overtaking him. The silhouette looked the same, but then when I saw the guns firing, I knew that we were coming toward each other, and we went the right path. When I turned around, he was gone.
That's one of those you don't even figure out what it was till it's gone, huh?
Well, dogfights are funny. They can be going on, you know, rather heavily, and then all of a sudden there's nothing. Everybody's gone. Some people took off for home, others, and it was important for us not to go chasing after them, because if you did, you left the bombers open to secondary attacks.
I thought that was a dynamic that was well depicted in the George Lucas film, Red Tails, that aspect of, hey, you got to stick to the plan, not be going for the glory and chasing down a fighter. Was that ever a temptation of yours to go after one of those German planes?
Well, you know, it's like once you get locked on to him, you know, you don't want to let go. But we had some well-grounded discipline, and that was don't be drawn off.
Where did that come from?
The commander. Colonel Davis was a man that had a tough job. What he had to do was to take people who were relatively raw. All of us, how far much more experience could you say one had? You know, guy graduated in first class, guy graduated a month later in second class. And he, from these people, had to take people for, or identify people for key positions. Squadron commanders, group operations officers, squadron operations officers, maintenance officers, you know. And he had to get the right guy. Best of all, he recognized when he had made a mistake with a guy, and he made the change right away. He did not mess around.
That's leadership for you. With all those missions, I'm sure you had plenty of close calls. But is there one for you that when you think back on, you feel like, you know, God was really looking out for me on that one?
Yes. We had some of those. I had a barge explode, and I flew through all that debris. Got through okay. And the ones that, not direct, but it happens. When on one mission, the fellow that was going to lead the mission said, "Who's flying Charlie today?" Charlie was the last position in the squadron.
Tail and Charlie.
So I said, "I'm flying Charlie." So he said, "Well, let's switch airplanes. Mine's a newer airplane, and Charlie has a lot more activity, you know, staying in formation and so forth. So you take that and I'll fly yours." He never came back. The airplane quit on him.
So that would have been you in the airplane that quit.
Yes. And other instances when attacking a ground target, you can see the rounds coming. And actually, you can do things about it. If it looks like it's going to hit you, you're okay, because it goes like this. But if it looks like it's going by in front, be careful. You better change something, change speed, change direction, change something, because it was pretty much hanging on to you then.
I'm sure you found plenty of bullet holes in your planes, but with stuff like that, with that anti-aircraft fire coming at you, what's the closest it actually came to hitting you? You personally, I mean your body, not your plane.
I never came close to being hit. I know that there were friends who had rounds go through the cockpit. You know, one guy, the first aid kit was behind your back. Took the first aid kit out. Another one, the round died just as it got there, and it stayed stuck in his windshield. Yeah.
Close enough. How much did you enjoy the plane you were flying? For people that haven't experienced that airplane, what was it like for you?
That airplane, the P-51, absolutely so far ahead of its time, it really can be said that it swung the war. It swung the things in our direction without question. And as far as the pilots feel, I didn't feel like I climbed into an airplane. I felt like I put it on. I wore it.
And the look on your face says you wouldn't mind wearing it again, that you would go out there right now if there was one out here on the tarmac.
I certainly would love to. Yeah, I know that people think I'm a little too old for that, but I don't think you ever forget some things, and that's one of them. They've let me fly the airplane sometime after we got up, and I fly it okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's important to tell the story of the Tuskegee Airmen? What's the value of that for us today in knowing what you guys did and what you went through?
Well, I think the most important aspects of it is not to let it happen again. We don't need it again. I think that all you have to do is look at the relationship to the people at events like this. Much different, much different. Some people, these people that you would probably never have had words for. What do you say? I know that the country itself has just absorbed so much in the way of the business and race relations. I feel that we should not even bother with considerations about race. I'm not saying that people should be not like their heritage. I like mine. I'm proud of my heritage. You know? But I don't think that it should be something that we say African-American, Indian-American, Mexican-American, Latin-American, German-American, Canadian-American. Who needs that? You an American or you not?
Frank words from the late Tuskegee Airman Bob Friend, and a challenge to each of us to live up to the ideals inked on parchment by our founding fathers, proclaimed by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. a couple hundred years later, and a target only a truly United States of America can ever achieve. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.